This episode of the Wired UK podcast is brought to you by Braintree V.0, the snippet of code that lets you accept PayPal, Apple Pay, and credit and debit cards in your mobile app or website, all with a single integration. To learn more and to try out the sandbox, go to braintreepayments.com/wired news. Coming up today, what Google searches reveal about the impending EU referendum, why Microsoft bought LinkedIn, and we go behind the scenes on the all-new Robot Wars. You're listening to episode 272 of the Wired UK podcast, your weekly guide to the best of science, tech, ideas, business, and design. I'm your host, James Templeton, and joining me are both Matts, Burgess and Reynolds.
Hello.
Hello.
Hello. I would like to apologise. There's a slight rumbling noise in the background. We are right next to a building site, and they are building. So apologies for the rumbling noise, but there's nothing we can do about it. This week, episode 2 of our Shenzhen documentary is now live. In this episode, we take a look at the maker movement and try and work out, once again, what the West can learn from China. Head to wiredvideo.co. Ooh, no. Head to wired.co.uk/video to watch. Episodes 3 and 4 are coming in the next couple of weeks. A thing you learned this week, Matt Reynolds.
Ooh. Okay, so this is a pub quiz favourite here, and it's group nouns for animals. So just, you know, warm us up. Guys, what's the group noun for a group of crows?
It's a murder.
Great, we know that one. What about giraffes?
A tower.
Tower of giraffes. Now, koalas.
A cuddle.
Matt?
I want to say possum, but that's just another animal.
It is another animal. You're both wrong, because there is no group noun. Because koalas are such solitary animals, there's just not a noun for a group of them, because they're always hanging out by themselves.
So they're never, like, getting together in a posse?
No. Essentially, they live in kind of, like, they like to have territories that overlap with other koalas, so they're kind of far away, but they're like, oh, you know, wave to each other, but they never hang out together.
Double fact, in a way. Matt Burgess, what's your fact this week?
This week I have learnt the longest distance that was actually cycled underwater. So to clarify this before I ask you to guess how far it was, the picture that I've seen and the basically where I learnt this from, the person is sitting on a bike with their head out of the water, but the rest of their body and the bike is underwater in like an enclosed
cage. So like the shallow end of a swimming pool.
But this was in a separate box, basically, a Perspex box. And I've actually got a fact about somebody swimming completely underwater, but we'll do that next.
20 miles?
Are they moving underwater, or they're stationary?
No, it's on a static bike.
I think it's going to be pretty tough. I'm going to say 30 miles, though.
855 metres.
Oh, so it's really hard.
Yeah, apparently.
Or maybe not many people try it because it's stupid.
It seems quite achievable, and apparently also, for if you're somebody completely submerged underwater, the distance was 6,000 metres, so quite a bit further.
What?
Wait, what? How does that make
sense?
Maybe
it's because there's less drag because their head isn't above. I don't know.
But they're not moving, so.
Well, let's find out and tell us next week. So I found out another watery fact. The ancient ancestors of whales had tiny back legs, which, I mean, you presume anyway, because they're mammals. But what's interesting about this is the early ancestors of whales were found in shallow waters off what is now Africa. And as the floodwaters were there for so long, they became semi-aquatic and they'd spend more and more time in water. So they needed their legs less. The legs shrunk. But when they were fully aquatic, they still had these two tiny, tiny little legs on the back of their bodies.
But they're gone now. We don't have them anymore.
Whales don't. I mean, you do. Yeah, you definitely have legs.
I have,
but you're not
tiny,
a whale.
Yeah, tiny, tiny legs.
From whales to robots, Matt Burgess, a few weeks ago you went to Glasgow in Scotland to go behind the scenes of the filming of the new series of Robot Wars. It's been away for a very long time. For those that don't know, what is Robot Wars and why are we so excited about it coming back?
So 12 years ago, when most of us three were growing up, there was a TV show called Robot Wars, and basically you have teams of engineers that build robots in their garages, in their sheds. Some are a bit more high-tech than that, and then they put them in an arena to fight.
And some of the technology was absolutely amazing, and 12 years later, there's a chance that it will be even better still. But first of all, Craig Charles and Philippa Forrester were the original presenters. Lots of people wanted them to come back for the new series, but the BBC's chosen two different presenters.
Yeah, so in part of the refresh of the show, they've picked two brand new people out. So we've got Dara O'Brien and Angela Scanlon, and they're both of the presenters do a bit of everything. So in the old series, Craig Charles used to be very much the face of the show, the first person that you would see, and Philippa Forrester was in the pit speaking to all the teams and discussing how their robots were being recreated and what they needed to do to rebuild them. But now that's been completely split, and there's a fair balance between both, so both presenters are doing a bit of everything.
So it'll feel like a slightly different show. And something else that's different, although similar, the house robots are also coming back. Well, some of them are, right?
Yeah, there are four house robots returning. For people don't know, are not familiar with the show, the house robots are robots that basically are produced by and built by the show. They sit in the corners of the arena, and if a robot gets too close to them, one of the competitors, then they will start attacking it, and they'll come out and sort of try to finish them off when they're actually close to the end of the battles. So there's four that are coming back. We've got Sir Kill-A-Lot, Shunt, Dead Metal, and Matilda.
And these house robots are way bigger and more powerful than the competitor robots are allowed to be. So they're maybe three or four times bigger and heavier.
Yeah, so these robots are absolutely massive. If you imagine Sir Kill-A-Lot is 750 kilograms and can lift 40 tons with one arm. And basically, the biggest of the robots, the competitor robots, is around 125 kilograms. So Sir Kill-A-Lot can lift absolutely anything like that is in front of him.
So he's pretty deadly. But these aren't the same house robots. I mean, they're the same names and they're kind of similar designs, but the technology has had to be upgraded massively because the robots that are competing in the arena are way better than they were 12 years ago.
Yeah, so these four are absolutely brand new recreations. They've been built by a company in Birmingham called RoboChallenge, and this company started from scratch and basically recreated all the robots, all the house robots in the same shapes and designs as they were before, but now they are just a lot bigger, heavier, faster. For example, Shunt weighs 300 kilograms and it used to weigh 105 kilograms. Its axe takes 0.6 seconds to hit its intended target. Dead Metal, which has a circular saw, spins at 4,000 RPM, and the robot has a top speed of 14 miles an hour. And Matilda, which is, I think it's a warthog or some sort of pig. Some sort of pig. Its chainsaw, which was coming out of its bum, has now been replaced with a circular saw which spins and is a lot more powerful and deadly.
So what's improved over the last 12 years that have made these, you know, robots so much better now?
So there's been quite a lot of technological changes. So if you think back 12 years ago, we were probably in the early days of the internet. And if you think how much that's come on, this is also the same in engineering and technology that goes into building robots. So Noel Sharkey, who was one of the judges on the original show and is actually coming back to this show. So the judges, they basically adjudicate on any fights where there isn't a clear winner. He said that the batteries are much lighter, the motors are better in the robots, they're more efficient, as the motors are smaller, so they can pack more power in there, and the armor is a lot stronger as well. They're using a material called Hardox, which is like a steel, basically.
Yeah, and that means that the weapons that the robots use and the house robots are fitted with need to be way, way stronger. Before, some of the robots were pretty flimsy, whereas now they're pretty hardcore.
Yeah, they are, and there's a range of different robots that I saw when we were going up there. Some are completely like robots that you've never seen before. So there was one that was called Gabriel, which looks a little bit like a Segway, but with a giant axe and just basically spins around with this axe. There's another robot called Pulsar, which has a spinning disc which goes at 9,000 RPM, which is incredibly quick and incredibly powerful. And when the spinning disc was running, you could hear it from across the warehouse as this was being filmed in, just sort of running like hundreds of meters away. And it was a little bit of a scary sort of feeling to hear this running.
So there's some of the new robots. Are we going to be seeing any of our favorite competitor robots back?
Well, this is where I'm going to have to not go into any big spoilers here. But when we were up there, Andrew Robertson, the series producer from the BBC, said that some of the old teams are coming back. But he did clarify that the world has changed. Those old robots are slightly behind the times compared to the new ones. So
if they are coming back, they'll need to be more or less completely rebuilt.
Yeah,
we'll wait and see what happens when the show airs a little bit later this year. Looking back, what are our favourite memories of Robot Wars?
So I loved one of the, you know, I think this is kind of a bit universally acknowledged here, Razor One of the best robots. I think they won two of the series. So they were seriously awesome and much kind of better looking than a lot of robots. Now, what I love about Razor is obviously the curse of Robot Wars was you can be as good a robot as you like, but if you get flipped over, if your ground clearance is too high, that's it.
The Shreemech.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. So it had these self-righting arm, self-righting arms that flipped out of this kind of little crushing claw that it had on top. And it was just so majestic to see it rise like a phoenix and kind of flip back on, like upright when it had been flipped over.
And it had the huge scorpion-like pincer. Was that Razor?
Yeah, that's right. So it was great. So it kind of, you know, obviously you got loads of different weapons. You got kind of axes and swords, and they're all kind of quick action. But Razor, it was kind of, it would kind of pincer you and then very slowly kind of pierce the robot. And it was really quite kind of horrible to
quite
watch.
Often it would get stuck as well. So it would just be, they'd just be there, dead together almost.
Yeah, exactly. It was just kind of impaled, like, you know, kind of like a, I don't know, like a wasp stinging a fly or something. It just, on the end of its little, you know, pincer thing.
What do you look back fondly on?
Well, there is one robot that I do look back fondly on, but just to go back to Matt's point of robots being flipped over, in the new series, you may or may not see some house robots getting flipped over as well. So they're not completely immune to being attacked and being destroyed. And the creator said if these robots weren't going to be flipped over, they'd have to be about 2 or 3 tons.
It's incredible to think, you know, these house robots are maybe the same weight as a small car, perhaps. I mean, they're really, really huge pieces of kit. So for these tiny competitor robots to be able to flip them over, the power that's involved there, that's pretty cool.
It is. And to go and to say what my favourite memory was from the old show was a robot called Diator, and it was a red robot which was basically covered in fur,
which is a bad idea,
and it was a red and black polka dots across it with some big googly eyes on there, and it used to get set on fire all the time by Sergeant Bash, one of the house robots, but Sergeant Bash hasn't been brought back this time.
It's tragic.
And James, you must have watched the show.
I've been trying to remember. I think my favourite was the countdown, right? 3, 2, 1, activate. It's like it just sticks in your memory, and the theme music, and when they go behind, when Philippa Frost used to go into the pits and see the robots, and they'd be so badly beaten up but they'd have to repair themselves for the next fight, and you'd see these amazing, like, total geeks who are trying to engineer these things back to life so they can fight again. And it was that introduction to engineering as a kid that was, I thought, was really exciting. So hopefully it inspires a whole new generation of people to go and tinker in the garage.
And that's one of the big points as well. There are a lot of family shows in Robot Wars. There used to be, and there still are. There is one, there's a 9-year-old girl who is a team captain of a robot called Glitter Bomb. So it's really a family show. And apparently there was some people on the show originally who got married, or there was some sort of relationship that came out of Robot Wars, or based around Robot Wars, and they've entered a new team now. So it's going to be really good to watch when it comes back on air later this year.
We don't know the date exactly, but we'll be telling you all the date as soon as we know it. Our second story this week is all about Brexit, or less annoyingly, the EU referendum. According to data from Google, searches for Leave massively outnumbered searches for Remain over the 7 days from May 31st to June 7th, which is interesting. But what's quite important here is that's just searches for, not support of.
So what were the most sort of popular questions? What were people really searching for? Do we know that?
Yeah, so Google's got this system called Trends, where you can monitor interest in anything from Justin Bieber to the EU referendum to your favourite football team. So the most popular question on the EU referendum during the period that Google analysed was, what is Brexit? Fair enough. Followed by, when is the EU referendum? Also fair enough. And UK search interest for queries relating to leaving the EU has sustained a healthy lead over questions about remaining. So Google put together a map of the UK, and on that map it looked at the Shire districts of England. There's 256 of them, and that's what we're going to be voting in this yes-no referendum. And only 9 of those districts have search terms, have searched more for terms relating to remain than leave. So the map of the entire of the UK is overwhelmingly dominated by people searching for terms relating to leave. So in Scotland, every area of Scotland, all but one in Wales and all but one in Northern Ireland, according to the data that Google put out. But as I said, this doesn't necessarily show that people are going to vote one way or the other. In fact, it doesn't at all. What it does show is more people are asking questions about leaving the EU than are asking questions about staying, which I guess makes sense, right?
I think it does, because that will be the big change, and if it does happen, rather than keeping the status quo. So yeah, it makes sense that people are searching for that.
So obviously around Brexit, there's been so much information from all different sources. And obviously with this data, it seems like people are looking to get these facts. But have people been finding them?
That's up for debate. I mean, I guess it depends where you end up once you've made that Google search. But the interesting thing about the data is Google has been quite secretive about the volumes of it. So it gives you an idea that Leave has quite a considerable search advantage over Remain, but you don't have any idea how big that advantage is, really. It has a measure, but it's not an absolute number, say 20 million searches for Leave the EU versus 4 for Remain. So it's quite unclear how big that advantage is and how much more people are searching. And as you say, once they make that search, what information are they getting? And I guess that's up to our journalistic colleagues across the country to make sure that that information is available.
Absolutely. Well, at least people are making an informed decision. It's good to see that people are searching for it full stop. You know, wherever they end up, it's really encouraging that there's that kind of, you know, desire to get this information.
Yeah. And so one of the questions that might make people smile, the most popular question relating to the referendum and former Mayor of London, Boris Johnson, was, will Boris Johnson be the next Prime Minister? Well, we'll find out the answer to that and lots of other questions when the UK goes to the polls on June 23rd. Elsewhere this week, Microsoft announced it was going to buy LinkedIn. In one of the biggest technology deals of the year, or ever, Microsoft has said it intends to buy LinkedIn for $26.2 billion. That's 18 billion pounds, which is quite a lot of money for a social network that I think has 500 million users compared to Facebook's billion plus, and is seen by many as more of a nuisance than a help. So the two firms have entered into a definitive agreement that will see Microsoft purchase the social network in an all-cash deal. Jeff Weiner, who will remain CEO of LinkedIn and report to Satya Nadella, CEO of Microsoft. Before the deal can be closed, it will need to be approved by LinkedIn shareholders and US regulators. But the big question that we asked this week is, imagine you're Microsoft for the day. Imagine you're a huge multinational corporation embodied within one human being. What would you do to make LinkedIn better, having spent billions of dollars to buy it?
Well, you're just staring at me, James. I'm going to go first on this one.
Please.
I think I would make LinkedIn's user interface better. I would make its design of its website better, because at the moment I find it really cluttered and really difficult to use and actually understand what's going on the website. And I mean, to be honest, I am not a big user of LinkedIn, but I know many people are, and I know many people have got jobs from LinkedIn and have a lot of recruiters and people trying to hire them into new jobs, headhunters coming to them, sending them messages saying, come and work for us instead of where you are at the moment. And as a journalist, I guess I use it as a research tool quite often to see where somebody works, what their job is, where they've been in the past. But as a direct usage, I don't look for a lot of information on there.
Yeah, so as a social network in that respect, it's unlike any other. Facebook isn't really useful for that. Twitter certainly isn't. And it's interesting, what will Microsoft's purchase of LinkedIn mean for LinkedIn? So apparently it won't be rebranded. It will remain independent, so it isn't going to start to be called Microsoft's social network for recruiters or whatever. But some things will change. Matt, you wrote the story earlier this week. Can you talk us through some of those changes?
Yeah, so there is going to be, there's very little information about what is actually going to change in the real world, but there are some indications of plans and early discussions what have been going on between the two companies. So there's one proposal that is very vague, but it's also saying there's going to be a LinkedIn news feed, which, yeah, I don't really know what that means, but it may be providing more different updates from people. I know there is some feature like that already on there, but maybe it'll be codifying a bit more, making it a bit easier to use or making it a bit timely. But also the company said that the combination, there's going to be new experiences such as Office suggesting an expert to connect with on LinkedIn when you're writing about something in Microsoft Office, or when you're trying to complete a task, it might recommend somebody you could contact and who would be able to help you a little bit more on
so
that.
The big thing here is it's bringing together Microsoft's business software, Office, Outlook, things like this, and bringing LinkedIn into that. So it's going to be quite a big data sharing exercise between the two companies. And that's why Microsoft has paid in the region of, I think, $180 per LinkedIn user in this deal. It wants that incredibly, incredibly valuable data to sell its products and its services and to get people using Microsoft rather than Google or Apple or Facebook. right?
Yeah, so Wiener in the announcement actually said that sponsored content providers, which are basically going to be advertisers and people who are using LinkedIn to push their own products and advertise with them, will actually be able to have, and I'm going to quote this directly here, the ability to reach Microsoft users across anywhere across the Microsoft ecosystem.
Which to a business development manager would sound absolutely thrilling, but to a normal human being probably sounds fairly terrifying.
It does, I think. I don't know. There is...
There are so many unknowns here.
There's so many unknowns, yeah. But that could mean anything from advertisers on LinkedIn or with LinkedIn being able to integrate adverts across your Microsoft products or your desktop, maybe a Windows phone if you own a Windows phone. It probably won't go that far, but from that vague description, that does sound like something where how this data is going to be shared across different platforms.
It's a bold new dawn. Matt Reynolds, what would you change?
Well, I'm trying to think about this from, not from the user's perspective, but from Microsoft. And I'm thinking LinkedIn is an amazing resource of working out where companies are doing new hires, what they're moving into, you know, who they're looking for, who they're interested in, who they're not interested in hiring. And I wonder, I kind of have a suspicion that that data is very, very valuable. Imagine if you knew that your competitor was suddenly hiring loads of people in VR. So that's going to give you a really cool clue about what's going to, you know, going to be happening. So I think that, you know, this is entirely speculative, but there might be a bit of rethinking of LinkedIn as a kind of business intelligence resource.
Yeah, it's interesting. So we also put this question out to our followers on Twitter. Tom Lawrence said that LinkedIn should open source its API. Christina Van Buskirk said that LinkedIn should improve its messaging system. The idea is to connect, not create disconnect, and it's been glitchy for years. Kenneth said, beef up security and make it a selling point and guarantee that Microsoft won't abuse our data. Damon Rose, who's a journalist at the BBC, said, make it more screen reader accessible and logical. Makes little sense if you're blind, and blind people need to network. And elsewhere, the Joe Partridge, Jeremy JD, Number 10 Cat, and Luke Bernard all said to sell it on again, which isn't particularly helpful for Microsoft, I don't think.
But no, and they're not going to sell it on again. But there's some interesting suggestions there from people about accessibility and basically changing LinkedIn to be more useful to people who are actually using it, which may not be Microsoft's initial changes that they make, but they could be well down the line as well. James, what would you change, or would you change anything?
I'd make it less annoying. Lots of people will say this. You get far too many emails from LinkedIn unless you change your settings to turn them off. And more often than not, I very rarely visit LinkedIn.
But
I find
all those people want to join your professional network.
Exactly, and have endorsed me for skills such as journalism and writing and podcasting, which is great, but it feels like it's more of a nuisance than a help, which is, I think, some of the feedback that we got on Twitter and the feeling of a lot of people writing up opinion pieces on this deal over the last week. Still to come, a big week for tech announcements. We'll round up and debate all the news from E3 and Apple's Worldwide Developers Conference after this.
By next year, maybe even next week, there could be a whole new way to pay. Maybe it'll be the next Bitcoin or the next Apple Pay, or maybe even both. Fortunately, Braintree's full-stack payment platform is easily adaptable to whatever the future holds, so you can adapt easily too. Accept everything from pounds to PayPal to that next big innovation, from any device with just one integration. And when that new payment method comes out, all you'll have to do is update a few lines of code. No late nights, no complicated recoding, no stress about staying ahead of the curve. Braintree is here to help. Learn more at braintreepayments.com/widenews.
Welcome back. So much news. Matt Reynolds, all the highlights from E3. Go.
Yeah, so E3, the annual big games conference in Los Angeles. So first up, big console news. Microsoft's revealing two new consoles, the Slim 9 Xbox One S, which is basically smaller, supports 4K video and has 2 terabyte storage. It's also white as well. That's coming out in the US in August and in Europe later. And also, more interestingly, Project Scorpio, which is like it deserves that kind of, you know, that anticipation. It's a super powered Xbox One, so it's optimized for virtual reality and 4K gaming. It's got 8 CPU cores and runs on 6 teraflops of graphics processing power.
It's interesting that Microsoft is keeping its consoles alive much, much longer. So I think the Xbox 360 was the longest surviving, if that's the right word, games console of all time. The Xbox One was around for quite a long time as well. So they're getting less stuck in the refresh cycle that we saw between the PS2 and the PS3 and the PS4. it's so that they're keeping these consoles around for longer and developing new, more powerful versions of them, which is an interesting development. So the move into VR, does that mean that Microsoft is going to start competing with the likes of Oculus and HTC? Because they have their own VR plans as well, right?
Essentially, we don't quite know. So Microsoft already said that Fallout 4 for VR will be one of the leading games when the Xbox Scorpion is released, which will be sometime in 2017. What we don't know, however, is whether Microsoft will have its own VR headset, a bit like PlayStation seems to be doing, or whether it'll kind of piggyback onto Oculus or HTC. So that's all remains to be seen.
I think it's pretty unlikely that Microsoft will be going into their own VR world because they've got their HoloLens, which is more of an augmented reality, mixed reality thing. But has PlayStation responded as well at E3?
Yeah, so not at E3, but just before E3, the PlayStation CEO confirmed the PlayStation Neo, or as it's been colloquially called, the PlayStation 4.5, which will basically be a ultra-high definition reboot of the PlayStation 4, and it's also going to support the upcoming PlayStation VR headset. So again, like James was saying, we're seeing like midway refresh cycles on consoles as opposed to wait 10 years and we've got PlayStation 5.
So, yeah.
Yeah, it's more progressive.
And it's funny that Sony chose to pull back from E3. I guess we'll get something more towards the end of the year when there tend to be the big console releases and game releases and things like that. So aside from the hardware, what about the big game announcements at E3? What are we excited about?
Okay, so first up, big releases. So virtual reality Fallout 4, I already just mentioned that. That's definitely coming out with the HTC 5 in 2017. So that's, you know, a direct port from the existing game, but very exciting because it was such a popular release. Skyrim's also getting a reboot for the current generation of consoles. So Skyrim Special Edition is basically the Skyrim we all know and love, except it's really, really beautiful and takes advantage of all that 4K processing power and all these kind of amazing graphics capabilities the new consoles have.
So the big updates from E3, and I think this is maybe a frustration that a lot of people have with the really, really big games releases, it's all about just the next release of a big game that we already know and love, or in this case, virtual reality ports of them.
Yeah, exactly. In fact, this E3 is kind of maybe a bit peculiar in that respect, because it's not just, oh, it's the next Call of Duty or something. You know, in the case of Skyrim, it's the same Skyrim, but prettier. It's the same Fallout, but in virtual reality. So, I mean, I guess what this showcases is that games producers they're really trying to squeeze out everything they can from these current releases, and we're not seeing a kind of, you know, what's the next Elder Scrolls, what's the next big Elder Scrolls release.
Yeah.
And one of the things that stood out for me was there's a lot of old games in there as well.
Yeah, sure. So sticking with Bethesda at the minute, they've released Quake Champions, which is a return of their like 20-year-old FPS shooter game. And this is the first one that's come out since 2007, sorry. And this time it's got a really big focus on esport. So they're kind of moving sport for gaming leagues beyond their existing QuakeCon event. And I know, James, you'll be excited by this. There's a new Zelda on the way. So this
I am just so excited. My voice might not sound like it, but Zelda is a dream world into which most of my childhood vanished.
Absolutely. And so, yeah, so lots of people will be very pleased to hear about this. It's going to be the Wii U's last game. So the last game for Nintendo's current console.
Thus justifying my stupid decision to buy a Wii U.
I know, exactly. It came right at the last gasp. Like, yeah, that's definitely worth it. So it's going to be called Legend of Zelda Breath of the Wild. And essentially this time, what's happened is that, you know, the real centerpiece for this world is the world of Zelda. You know, before it was kind of all about the characters. You got that in the subtitles of the Zelda games. But actually now we've got a kind of massive world that has a lot of kind of open world RPG elements. So we've got bigger inventories, more weapons and more customizable stuff. So quite exciting for Zelda fans, I think.
And very exciting news that more stuff will be breakable.
Yeah, exactly.
As a big fan of Ocarina of Time and Majora's Mask, there was nothing more fun than going into a house and just smashing all the pots.
Oh, and now you can use the environment to kill enemies. So you see that kind of like slightly unstable rock over there. You know, push it over to someone, on someone.
Yeah, so one of the most amazing things about Ocarina of Time, sorry to harp on about it, is when you went out into Hyrule Field, right, and you're riding on a pony into the sunset towards Hyrule Castle, and it all looks very, very beautiful. But there were limits to that world. There were things hidden away that you could find and places to explore. But it felt like a game that is absolutely designed for what games consoles are now capable of in terms of open world environments and almost limitless game worlds. Once you put that around Zelda, you have an amazing story arc and characters, and now the world that can support that kind of diversity and world, right?
Yeah, absolutely. It's almost like with Zelda that the consoles of the technology has finally caught up with the kind of vastness of that idea. So really, Breath of the Wild is all about exploration. It's all about amazing scenes and you know, great mountain spaces, and it's all about, you know, encouraging people to get out there and poke around, see what's there.
And also from the past.
Yeah, so more reboots. Crash Bandicoot is making actually a number of returns. So first off, you know, this platform hero from our, you know, earlier days, from the days of the original PlayStation, in fact. I remember having it on PS1. It'll be coming to Skylanders Imaginators in October as guest characters. But the actual classic Crash Bandicoot, Crash 2 and Crash 3 Warped games will be fully mastered in a trilogy pack for PS4.
It's almost like there are no original ideas left.
Yeah, there are. There were some original ideas from E3, but I think the real kind of headlines are, you know, some Pokemon reboots as well. You know, reboots of classic games and redressing of not so old games.
Which is all right for old timers like us and older timers out there. But for the new and up and coming games, there was less of that at E3. And it tends to be now that they're announced on their own, that the big games companies are big enough to have launches outside of E3. Mm. So we can expect those announcements pretty much at any time when a game company wants to go, ta-da, here's our new IP.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, there's some, you know, interesting ones, like this new Battlefield that's set in the First World War. That looks really exciting. New Gears of War, you know, the ceaseless updates to Call of Duty. You know, all that kind of stuff that you expect. But I think, yeah, the big news is kind of old news for this year.
Yeah, and Nintendo's new console still remains a mystery, but will allegedly be out pretty soon, so we'll have to wait and see what that does to get us away from the endless tide of shooting things in the face. Apple, Worldwide Developers Conference. This is Apple's annual, this is obviously moving away from E3, Apple's annual big developers conference, where it also announces lots of updates that us normal people can get excited about away from the developer community. Matt, would you like to kick off with some of the big updates that Apple announced earlier this week?
Okay, so at Apple's event in San Francisco, they announced updates across four areas that are all fairly linked. So they updated their operating systems for their TV system, the watch system, the MacBooks operating system, and also the iOS, the iPad, and iPhone operating system. So all pretty fairly big components of how our devices work. There was no new hardware, but there are still some big changes in there.
Yeah, so this is all about its four major operating systems, and quite a lot of it is about making them more similar and linking them together better. So let's start with iOS.
So iOS, so we're talking iPhones, iPads here. Apple updated 10 big different things that it outlined on stage. We're not going to go through them all because there were some that they would consider big, but other people may not do. But one of the big things for us, and it's a trend across the whole of the technology industry, is artificial intelligence being deeply embedded into their products.
And Apple's going about it a different way. So it was very keen to point this out, that it's artificial intelligence, but without potentially sacrificing your privacy.
Yeah, so they said that all of the artificial intelligence updates that they were doing are going to be stored locally on a device. The algorithm is going to run on a device rather than in the cloud or sending the data across to Apple. And probably the biggest one of these, and one where people would have privacy issues if it was being sent externally from a phone or from an iPad, is Photos. So the Photos app on the devices is now actually going to be running AI and in a deep learning context where it is picturing together all of your pictures. So it will scan all your pictures, it will look at each individual one of them and say, this one looks like another one, and then group them in a way that you can see.
So the idea being that if you took a weekend in the mountains or went skiing, it would put those together in an album and say, here are the highlights of your skiing trip. Or it might recognize faces and start to learn who those people are and group together all of your photos of your kids or your wife or whoever else in your family. Yeah,
yeah, and they're not the only people to have done this. So for example, Google's Photos app, that runs off a similar sort of AI which groups stuff together. So if I went onto my phone now, there would be a folder in the Google Photos app which lists all types of dogs and pictures that I've taken, pictures of dogs. So yeah, that's not unique to Apple. But
what is unique is it's happening on the device, and that's a big distinction that Apple's making between itself and Google and Facebook, is that we're all about privacy, guys. We fought the FBI and we won, sort of, in a way. That isn't the only place that AI is making a big impact on iOS, right?
It's not. It's also going to be in messages, and this is a bit that is really sounds quite clever in a way. So messages will expand their prediction software, basically. Apple's or iPhones already sort of predict the next word you want to type, or if you type the first letter in, they'll start to predict it. But it's going to go a bit further than that. It's going to go a bit deeper into your system and look across different different apps, really. So if I was to, if Matt Reynolds was to send me a text message saying, have you got James's email? The iPhone would say to me, if I've got your email stored in my phone, James, this is the this is your email. Do you want to send this directly? So it's sort of integrating different apps, different pieces of data and software across your whole iOS device.
Yeah, and so that's about opening up an access. And there was some other news to do with opening up an access to make the slightly shonky link and letting third-party developers into Apple's software.
Yeah, so this is potentially quite a big one, although it does sound very developer focused. So Maps, Messages, and also Siri, Apple's virtual assistant, are going to have open access to developers. So basically, if people want to, if developers want to integrate their own apps into these services and use them, then they will be able to. So to give an example, if I was to say to my phone, hey Siri, can you send a WhatsApp to James? It will actually be able to use WhatsApp to send this message, rather than at the moment, it's all a very closed platform, and Siri only works with Apple products.
So it's a change that definitely needed to be made.
What else was there on the in terms of iOS updates then?
So this is potentially one that excites a lot of people. You're actually going to be able to delete the default apps on the iPhone and iPad for the first time. So you can get rid of Stocks, Maps, a number of the apps that are on there that you probably don't use or have alternatives for. And this is like the first time that Apple's actually done this since, well, ever.
So I think Stocks and Tips will be the two big ones, which most people surely could never have used, right?
Yeah, but I think the bigger picture is that Apple is actually letting people change their phones a little bit more. So it's changing its entire outlook, which it might not have done under Steve Jobs. But it's actually, yeah, this is a different way for you to use the iPhone. It's saying, oh, we sort of accept that not everybody is going to use our mail app. People might want to use a different mail app, so do it.
Yeah, so I'm going to very, very quickly run through the changes to tvOS, because this is probably the least interesting bit. So minor changes for tvOS. These include the addition of some more streaming services and apps, Sling, Fox Sports Go, Molotov. A lot of these announcements are quite US-focused, so there's not a lot for the UK and Europe. Minecraft Story Mode is also being adapted for tvOS, and this will be able to be played on the new remote app. And this is probably the biggest announcement, that rather than using the Siri app that the Siri remote that comes with Apple TV, you can now use your phone or your iPad, which makes text entry way easier, and it uses the accelerometer and the gyroscope and the touchscreen and voice control. So if you don't want to use the remote, which is a bit limited in functionality, you can use your phone or your iPad, which is a lot more powerful and useful. And it's in developer preview at the moment, but it will be coming out later in the year, as with all of these updates, I think. Let's hop back to WatchOS.
So yeah, the WatchOS has been upgraded to OS 3, which is obviously the third iteration of the Watch operating system. And there's a few new things in there. There's a lot that's focused on fitness. One really nice thing to do with accessibility is that the features have now been included to basically the watch will work with disabled people who are trying to do exercise. So there is a mode on there that will, instead of telling you to stand up and to do some exercises, the watch prompts you to do every now and again, it will tell wheelchair users it's time to roll. And there's a few specific exercise programs on there that are for wheelchair and disabled users. And also one of the other big things is how you send messages on the watch. So this is something that is also on the new iOS for iPad and iPhone as well, but you can now do handwriting to send a message. So if you have to enter individual letters one at a time, but if you just drew an A on your watch in a message, then it will come up as an A. So it's slightly easier than talking into your watch.
Yep. And the last operating system, Mac OS, or as it used to be known, OS X. So it's got a new name, Mac OS, and the first subtitle will be Mac OS Sierra, that's going to take a bit of getting used to. Siri has been added to the Mac desktop. It can access files, play music, send messages, and more. And Apple Watch users will also be able to unlock macOS just by walking up to their computer, obviously so long as they're wearing an Apple Watch. Apple Pay is also coming to the web, and by extension, that means it's coming to your Mac. Supported websites will show a button for contactless payment for Apple's contactless payment method, which was previously only supported in apps. Although, confusingly, payments made by the web will still need to be authenticated on an iPhone or Apple Watch. Apple has also added synchronized copy and pasting across all devices, which is really good news. And this will make it possible to take text on your iPhone and copy it and then paste it on your Mac instantaneously. It's the sort of thing that browser add-ons and apps have done for a while, and now Apple is, to use the horrible phrase, baking it in to its operating systems. So in many ways, Apple's taking ideas that already exist, right? And making these ideas its own.
It very much feels like it's playing catch-up in some areas and doing them in its own way. But I think one of the important things for me about this, and as somebody who is an Apple user of multiple Apple products, although not a watch, is the continuity across all devices. So Apple's trying to make it easier for people to be able to use their iPhone and their Mac and their iPad all in one go. So, for example, the copy and pasting thing, if you copy something on your iPhone, you'll be able to paste it on your computer. It's quite clever, and there are a lot of dedicated Apple users out there. So these sort of things, just the synchronicity between them all, will make a big difference for some people, I think.
A fight between E3 and WWDC. E3 purely on Zelda alone.
Crash Bandicoot.
Not Crash Bandicoot. Come on. Has me way more excited. Did you actually like Crash Bandicoot?
Yeah, it was fantastic. The best one was Crash Team Racing, where you're in little go-karts, like his own Crash's Mario Kart version. They bring that back, I'll buy a PS4 for that. Or the new PS.
Just play Mario Kart because it's better, right?
But it hasn't got Crash Bandicoot.
That's a good thing.
Oh.
Silence. Okay, we will leave it there and we'll be back next week. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
Yeah. Matt Burgess, fact me.
I'm going to fact you, and I'm going to fact you very hard. What's the... We can't do that.
That's horrible. Oh, my God.
02. Oh, no. 35.
That's...
Okay, that was strange. Right.